This is PGI. Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good morning and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded September the 4th, 2014. Please be aware that there will be no presenter video during today's live meeting session. I'd now like to turn the conference call over to your speaker today, Dr. Marion Taylor. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for the opportunity to give this talk on a topic that has fascinated and preoccupied me for a long time, and is indeed the subject of a great deal of writing by others with far greater wisdom and knowledge than I. This is, of course, a huge topic, and we will only be skimming the surface of it today. It seems to me now that in palliative care, so much of our work is dependent on being able to be reasonably accurate in this area. This is particularly so in our small service, where resources are precious, and we need to target those whom we can best help. I'm sure this is the case for you too. Every day, I'm asked for a prognosis so that we can accept, transfer, or seek appropriate funding for a patient. It is now simply expected. But I never had any training in this, and in my discussions with colleagues, and the trainee interns from the Otago School of Medicine who come to the GP practice and the hospice, neither did they. Cast your mind back a little or a long way. What sort of teaching have you had in this area? So, how do we learn how to give a prognosis? Slide 2. These are the objectives I aim to cover. I'll give you a moment to read them. Oops, sorry, that's slide 3. Oops. Slide 3. Hippocrates thought that doctors should pay attention to prognosis, and that if a doctor was familiar with the patient's symptoms and able to predict the likely outcome of the disease, as well as able to surmise the missing information, he would be highly trusted by his patients. I think we may largely agree with Hippocrates. Certainly, I think that patients and families continue to have some confidence that we can give them at least an idea about prognosis. Professor Liz Lobb, who presented in the series in May on bereaved carers of women with ovarian cancer, touched on prognostic uncertainty as one of the major stress factors for carers. If we in palliative care are unable to give a prognosis, who can? Slide 4. Just having a little difficulty with the slides here, but we'll get there. Slide 4. The history of the human ability to prognose is interesting, and it seems to go back as far as there are written records. Mantic prognosis refers to the use of omens and magic to foretell the outcome of an illness, and is as old as humanity and still practiced today. While semiotic prognosis is dependent on clinical findings and dates back to the Sumerian civilization of 2000 BC. By Hippocrates' time in 400 AD, the three cardinal skills of diagnosis, prognosis, and therapeutics were equally relevant. The advent of effective treatments changed all that, and an inverse relationship developed between therapeutic and prognostic skills. As the one rose, the other fell away, and this has remained the case for a long time. Harvard Professor of Healthcare Policy and Medical Sociologist Nicholas Christakis has studied the content of the standard medical textbooks and has shown that there is very little mention of prognosis as long as new and more effective treatments are being developed for a condition, for example, pneumonia. Christakis searched the textbooks from 1892 to 1988 and noted a steady decline in the mention of prognosis in relation to pneumonia. This is understandable, as we no longer expect patients to die from this, perhaps even in palliative care. But there is definitely no mention of how to formulate any kind of prognosis in the great textbooks. Christakis talks of a renaissance in the need for discussion about prognosis because of current trends in chronic illness, longevity, and fewer new medications for chronic conditions. Slide 5. Slide 5. So prognosis is an epidemiological term defined as the relative probabilities of the various outcomes of the natural history of a disease and can be made about any outcome of an illness. So in slide 6, Fries and Ehrlich in 1981 came up with the 5 D's of prognosis to illustrate the domains in which a prognosis can be offered. Slide 7. This is an illustration of how doctors are providing this kind of information to patients anyway, whether in oncology, general practice, medicine, surgery, or palliative care. The oncologist might talk about the likely progression of the disease and that not everyone with cancer gets pain. The GP or hospice doctor might talk about the side effects of the opiates and the chances of getting them. That is, the side effects. The hospital social worker might want to discuss the patient's likely prognosis so that the appropriate funding stream can be used. The surgeon, physician, or oncologist might talk about the 5-year survival of the patient's type of cancer. Slide 8. So I'd like to talk about some of the reasons that we need to be able to give a prognosis in palliative care, and for that matter, in general practice to a certain extent. The advanced care planning movement has brought this more vividly into perspective, I think, as much of the language of these documents is about end of life, and GPs are beginning to engage with this. In hospice, patients often ask, "How long have I got?" And if they don't ask, family members certainly do. Families are scattered nationally and globally. People may need to come from far afield, and they have jobs and airline tickets. They want to know how long this is all going to go on, and often they don't want to return home and come back again for a funeral. There are significant economic pressures, and the burden of caring is not easily borne in modern times. But it's not all doom and gloom. I vividly remember a prognostic talk with a patient who only wanted to know if she should buy summer shoes. And she did. Although you might say there was a deeper question there. Doctors need to know whether to continue with investigations and treatments or to have those difficult discussions with patients about letting go of chemotherapy, blood transfusions, and so on. Hospices have criteria for accepting patients. Ours, as a general rule, takes people with a year or less to live, so someone has to determine whether this patient fits our criteria. I was talking to a doctor at a hospice in the US recently, where hospice is only available to those with 6 months or less. And there is perpetual tension between the hospice doctor and the insurance company about getting this right. Money even sometimes has to be paid back if the patient outlives the prognosis. We're lucky we don't have that problem in New Zealand. In Whanganui, we have access to a fully funded, non-means-tested residential care package for a patient who will live longer than 2 weeks but less than 9 weeks. The disability allowance, on the other hand, is only granted to those with a prognosis of 6 months or more. So you can see there is some potential for creativity and dishonesty. I think that healthcare professionals have a duty to be as honest as possible in their formulating and communicating prognoses to patients, families, and other healthcare professionals if we are to work together to solve some of the tensions around end-of-life care. Slide 9. The literature about doctors' willingness or ability to discuss prognosis is not encouraging. These have been the norms and may still be in many healthcare settings. Sociologist Renee Fox talks about the learned avoidance in medical training of topics such as prognosis and terms this structured silence. There is a lot of literature demonstrating that doctors, for all sorts of understandable reasons, tend to be over-optimistic if they do give a prognosis. Slide 10. So let's look at some of the issues for healthcare professionals. Generally, doctors find this area very difficult, stressful, and uncertain. They have no training in it. They worry about getting it wrong. They worry that they will upset the patient and that somehow by giving a poor prognosis they will change the patient's behavior and make this come true. Christakis, in his book Death Foretold, Prophecy and Prognosis in Medical Care, devotes an entire chapter to physicians' beliefs relating to the self-fulfilling prophecy. Doctors may also be under pressure to collude with family members in avoiding discussion about prognosis. They may feel helpless about lack of treatments or overly optimistic about yet another potentially effective drug. As we've already mentioned, the more drugs there are available, the less frequently discussions about prognosis occur, for example, in hematology. Doctors fear being judged and held accountable by colleagues, patients, and families. There is pressure to be accurate and honest while maintaining hope, an almost impossible task. Slide 11. These are some of the statements patients have remembered when asked if they've been given any idea of prognosis. I need to point out that I'm not criticizing my colleagues here. I'm simply recording some of the types of prognostic statements that have been made to patients and that they've remembered. And they were generally unhelpful. The first statement is interesting. Christakis discusses the widespread prohibition against prognostication, which is internalized in the medical profession, and reflects the belief that it is even arrogant or unethical to offer prognoses, as if one were playing God. If one were to make a prognosis, one might then be held responsible for the outcome. He goes on to explain the emergence of religious sentiments in this aspect of medical practice as a way of coping with the strain posed by the limits of the human ability and the threat of death. The third statement was made in a kindly way by a surgeon, but the patient was still left with no idea of whether he had weeks or years to live. The fifth statement, but the surgeon said he'd got it all, was made by a patient who was utterly shocked to discover that he was dying 2 months later. I phoned the surgeon to see if he was surprised about this, and he freely admitted that he had been over-optimistic, so as not to destroy hope. Slide 12. This slide is to illustrate that there are two parties involved in a prognosis and two tasks, foreseeing and foretelling. The two images are quite different, I think. On the cover slide, I had an image of a crystal ball reader. There's a common scenario in the hospice where a family member follows me out of the patient's room and says, "I know you people don't have crystal balls," and then there's an awkward silence usually, and then the question, "But how long would you say she's got?" The man in this crystal ball image is seated at the same level and has paid for or is probably going to pay for the service. It looks like an equal transaction. Christakis talks of the prognostician as more of a prophet, in a less equal relationship with the patient as a supplicant. He goes on to consider that it is this role of God, prophet, or bearer of bad news that doctors find so uncomfortable. Slide 13 looks at ways that we can compile a prognosis. We could refuse or guess. We could get an expert opinion or look at large population databases. In pursuit of accuracy, we could use evidence-based medicine by performing a literature search and critically appraising the articles for relevance to our patient. This method is extremely time-consuming. Glare and Christakis have done much of this work for us in their book Prognosis in Advanced Cancer, and they have compiled a list of median survival times for the common cancers, which can be enormously helpful. They've also written extensively on prognostic indicators in individual cancers and different cancer complications such as jaundice or hypercalcemia. Or we could simply rely on our own experience, or perhaps a combination of these in using a prognostic tool, and we'll look at some of these later on. Slide 14. This is to emphasize the difference in prognosis early in the cancer journey compared with later. It looks at prognostic factors at the time of diagnosis. Far from the time of death, this experience is less threatening for patients. Percentages of 5-year survival can create a comfortable distance from the event. It is interesting to note that patients often hear what they want to hear, and the five-year bit sometimes sticks. Sadly, the gap between when they see the oncologist and when they reach the hospice, for example, can be quite narrow, and there is then a lot of reframing to be done. Different markers are used by different specialists to assess progress, and it's useful to know what these are if we're to have a common understanding of the stage that the patient is at. For example, we've shared myeloma patients with a hematologist who use the beta-2 microglobulin as a prognostic marker, when we at hospice are looking more at things such as performance status. I think it's enormously helpful when specialists document their discussions about prognosis in their letters to other professionals. Slide 15. As the disease progresses, there is a final common pathway that has less to do with the specific disease or its markers and more to do with the patient's general condition. The rate of progression of the cancer gives us some clues. It's a dynamic process, changing all the time, and it can be a real shock for patients and families when the original prognosis of 6 months turns out to be more like 6 weeks. Slide 16. So what help is there by way of prognostic tools? Well, there are quite a number. Christakis and Glare have done a vast literature search for prognostic scoring systems that may have practical application. And these are some of the results. To date, the palliative prognostic score, developed by Pirovano and co-workers in Italy in 1999 in hospice home care patients, has been validated in a variety of settings. The parameters used are dyspnea, anorexia, Karnofsky performance status, which is a functional score from 0 to 100, where 0 is dead and 100 is alive and well. Then the clinician's prediction of survival in weeks, that is, the gut feeling, the total white cell count, and the percentage of lymphocytes. And there's a score for each of these and a total which puts patients into a risk category. And we'll look at an example of this later. One of the limiting factors, perhaps, is the reliance on clinician estimates, which, as we know, tend to be somewhat optimistic. Another scoring system in use, and this was discussed recently at the ANSPAM meeting as useful, is the palliative performance scale, a functional tool similar to the Karnofsky and developed in Victoria, Canada. It includes activity and evidence of disease, ability to self-care, oral intake, and conscious level. However, it does not include blood variables or symptom scores, and although it can point to prognosis, there are no associated time frames. The Palliative Prognostic Index was developed in Japan by Morita and colleagues, also in 1999. It uses 5 clinical variables, including the palliative performance scale mentioned above, along with oral intake, presence or absence of edema, dyspnea at rest, and delirium. Patients are divided into 3 survival groups, less than 3 weeks, less than 6 weeks, or more than 6 weeks. The Glasgow Prognostic Score of 2005 uses CRP and albumin to give a score of 0, which is normal, 1, which is for a raised CRP of greater than 10, or a reduced albumin of less than 35 grams per liter, or 2, where both the CRP are raised and the albumin is low, with 2 indicating a poor outcome. But again, no time frames are attached to the scores. The filionomogram, developed in Spain between 2003 and 2007, uses 5 variables to predict survival to 15, 30, and 60 days in terminally ill cancer patients. The variables are ECOG status, that is a 0 to 5 functional tool, where 0 is alive and well and 5 is dead. Albumin, LDH, lymphocyte count, and clinician prediction of survival. This tool has met the European Association for Palliative Care's 7 quality criteria for undertaking palliative prognostic scores. The Prognosis in Palliative Care study has 11 core variables, which include pulse, general health, mental test, performance status, anorexia, metastatic disease at any site, liver metastases, CRP, white cell count, platelets, and urea. And it has the capability of predicting from 2 weeks to 2 months survival without relying on clinicians' estimates. Slide 17. Shows an example of the palliative prognostic score. I've been using this tool for the past 2 to 3 years with moderate success. I scored 66 consecutive patients, excluding those who were actively dying, and excluding hematology patients whose white cell counts would not be relevant. And I scored them on admission to hospice and found that they generally died within the predicted time frames. There is insufficient time here to present this data, but I've continued to base my prognoses on the system, although it is limited in its ability to predict longer than a month. The results fall into one of three groups: low, medium, or high risk. Those in the low group have a greater than 70% chance of a month's survival, while those in the high risk group have less than 30% chance of a month's survival. In the low risk group, of course, there is a chance of living longer than a month. The score is strongly influenced by the clinician's prediction, which may tend to be over-optimistic. Slide 18 is an example of the score in practice. This was a 72-year-old woman with esophageal cancer who presented to hospice quite late in her diagnosis, having had radiotherapy. And on admission, she had quite severe dysphagia, anorexia, and shortness of breath. It was probably fairly obvious to all of us that her prognosis was poor, but I did the score anyway, and I gleaned from the family that they had been given no prognostic information at all. They were expecting years at least, and they were utterly shocked when they asked me about prognosis. They wanted to know the prognosis, and they were utterly shocked when I told them that it was rather short, and she did die within 3 weeks. But at least they had a little time to prepare. Slide 19. On a lighter note, one thing that fascinates me, and I'm sure you've all come across it, is the confounding phenomenon of the patient who hangs on until a particular day, anniversary, birthday, or Christmas. I was interested to know if there was any evidence base for this. And I found this article by Phillips and Smith in the Journal of the American Medical Association dated 1990, describing a dip in mortality before significant national holidays and a peak in mortality in the following week in two different groups in California, two different ethnic groups, that is. The conclusion was that the same phenomenon might occur in relation to other significant events, such as personal birthdays, anniversaries, Christmas, and so on. Unfortunately, subsequent studies have failed to replicate this, notably a large American study by Don and Haid, published in the same journal in 2004, entitled Holidays, Birthdays, and Postponement of Cancer Death. With the exception of black patients, who showed a small increase in mortality in the week before Thanksgiving, and female patients, who showed a small increase in mortality the week after their birthday. I still maintain that we seldom have a hospice death on Christmas Day. We did have a patient last year who had a very poor prognosis, I thought, but who was absolutely determined to reach Christmas Day, and indeed he did, but he was unconscious on the day and died on Christmas Day. I would be interested to hear your experiences of this phenomenon. Slide 20. Whenever we have a family meeting, I feel that prognosis is the elephant in the room, and it is often not talked about until after the meeting, as I mentioned earlier. This then usually involves organizing another family meeting so that the patient can be included in this discussion. It is a delicate business. If the patient gives permission for this discussion to happen without their involvement, one can proceed comfortably to have that discussion with the family. Slide 21. Prognostic and end-of-life communication is a vital skill for healthcare professionals caring for patients with progressive life-limiting illnesses and their families. Patients have the right to know, or, of course, not to know. Giving a prognosis cannot be done off the top of one's head at the bedside, I think. I like to go away and look at all the information from the time of diagnosis and to formulate the prognosis as accurately as I can, and this takes time. The Australian guidelines, which were drawn up, the Australasian guidelines, which were drawn up in 2007, and New Zealand's very own Dr. Jonathan Adler was on the expert advisory group, use the acronym PREPARED. And I will go through this as I think it is important. It is similar in some ways to the SPIKES protocol for breaking bad news. So P is for preparation before discussion, confirming the pathological diagnosis, ensuring privacy, and negotiating who will be present. Oops. Slides are jumping about. There we go. R is for relating to the person, developing rapport, and showing empathy. E is for eliciting patient and caregiver preference, checking expectations, clarifying understanding, and finding out how much they want to know, and considering cultural and contextual factors. P is for providing the information, pacing the information, explaining the uncertainty and limitations of prognostic information, and trying to ensure consistency of approach to the patient and family. A is for acknowledging emotions and concerns, responding to patient and caregiver distress. R is for fostering realistic hope, being honest without being blunt, avoiding false hope, reassuring that support and resources are available without giving premature reassurance, exploring and facilitating realistic goals and wishes. E is for encouraging questions, checking understanding, and enabling further discussions. And finally, D is for documentation in the medical records and dissemination to other health professionals, such as the patient's GP. In talking about prognosis, it is, of course, important to talk in terms of a range, days to weeks, weeks to months, or 4 to 6 months, so that patients do not become fixated on a particular point in time. People differ in their ability to take in figures. Percentages and graphs can be cold to some people, while acceptable to others. And how many times do we hear, "It's not what you say, but it's the way that you say it"? Slide 22, just a little light relief. This was thanks to Dr. Wiseman at the ANSPAM meeting recently. I know that some of you have already been thinking about non-cancer conditions. And yes, there are prognostic tools for non-cancer diagnoses, such as the BODE index for COPD patients, that's body mass index, airflow obstruction, dyspnea, and exercise capacity. And my colleague in the American hospice is using all the tools she can get her hands on. The non-cancer conditions can be tricky, as the trajectories are so very variable. However, we have up to 50% non-cancer patients under our care, so we will need to become more proficient in this area. Slide 24. So, does prognosis have a good prognosis? I think so. The newer targeted therapies in many of the cancers are prolonging patient survival with advanced and metastatic cancer. For example, in bowel and breast cancer, patients are living much longer to get such complications as cerebral metastases. So, the disease patterns may change. I'm quite sure that there will be better prognostic tools in the future, and apps that we can download, such as those we already use for cardiovascular risk assessment. But I do think that patients and families will still look to doctors to provide prognoses for a long time to come. Slide 25. In conclusion, I think giving a prognosis is often important. It is difficult for good reasons and often has limitations. Many doctors try to avoid it and tend to be over-optimistic, but patients and families want this information and they want it given compassionately and honestly. So the language we use is important. There are validated tools and there are useful guidelines. Prognostication is a crucial skill which I think can be learned and taught, and I think it should reclaim a place in medical curricula. Christakis, in his book Death Foretold, goes so far as to say that doctors have a duty to prognosticate if we are to enable people to achieve the much lauded goal of a good death. Thank you very much for listening, and I would be interested in your thoughts and opinions.